Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Airtime, extended conversations with interesting people. This week, an up-close look at the first hours of the migrant experience at the U.S.-Mexico border and the power of public art. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio's new show, Airtime. Stay tuned. Longtime Carbondale local, Ellie Davis, spent a week in McAllen, Texas earlier this fall. She worked at the Humanitarian Respite Center of the Rio Grande Valley. The organization picks up asylum seekers who are released into the country at the border and provides showers and helps to contact families within the U.S. Davis is living in Sweden now, but the coverage of the conditions of asylum seekers entering the U.S. and the revelation that children were being removed from their parents made her take action. I talked to her about her motivations for coming home to help and what she learned in doing so. Are you a news junkie? I mean, you're sitting in Sweden. What were the reports coming in, or what were some of the images you were seeing that made you aware that this was happening?
Facebook. I mean, the majority of my Facebook friends are in the U.S. So then you see one thing on Facebook, and then hopefully one researches what one reads on Facebook. And that was actually a big part of wanting to go to Texas as well. I really felt like I had to go see, like, okay, is this fake news? Is it hyperbole? Are we being fed a line? And by one side, by both sides, you know, what? I just had to go see for myself what was the truth.
So you drove there.
We drove there.
Do you remember rolling up?
Totally. I mean, yeah. Yeah, I do remember rolling in. And I mean, probably the first thing that hit us was 100% humidity. Like, yeah. And seeing the respite center, the Rio Grande Respite Center, and, you know, it's not a cheery building. You know, it's like, you know, when you pass it, like, oh, there's going to be pain once we go in those doors.
What was your role? Tell me about your time there.
So I have to say, I would never in a million years work this hard for money. So this was my role. I was the queen of the laundry and showers. Yeah, it was pretty much 10 hours a day in a sauna, like running back and forth, 300 towels. And the thing is, it doesn't sound like very, you know, making sure that the showers are clean for the next people. And it doesn't sound like it's much, but I got to tell you, like, we're talking about people who have been, many of them, on a journey by foot from, you know, Honduras. And then they get to the U.S. and, you know, who knows how long it had been since they'd gotten any kind of care on their journey. You know, some came on this train that they call the Beast, which is, I mean, it's a horrible, like, people riding on the roof. People lose limbs frequently. You know, people fall off. And I mean, it is the journey that these people take. They're not going on a journey like this just because they want our jobs. They are truly fleeing for their lives. So after that, they get to the U.S. They try to make a legal pathway, right? They think they're doing everything they need to do. And then they get to the bridges. And the current administration they've set up these guard posts. Those were not there 2 years ago. and because if people make it onto U.S. soil, they are permitted to ask asylum. So what they've done is they're telling people that they have to wait on the bridge, and they don't know how long. Sometimes there have been people there for a month waiting for their number to be called to go in, to make their case. So they run out of money, or they run out of hope when they've been on this for so long. So what they do is they try to find another route in. So they're pushed into doing an illegal crossing. And then now that this administration is prosecuting illegal crossings as a crime, that's a mark against their bid for citizenship. So they face this, which they weren't expecting. They don't know about this. There's not the communication. You know, they think it's a deterrent, these guys. It's not a deterrent because they don't have the same communication technologies that we have, you know? Okay, so at the respite center, after all of this harrowing stuff, ICE drops them off at Greyhound with nothing. The respite center picks up van loads of people and brings them back to the respite center. They feed them. They give them a shower. We had 8 showers total to accommodate everyone coming through the center. Clean clothes when they're available. And that was, I mean, I can't tell you how heartbreaking it was to have to tell these people. Sometimes I wanted to burn their clothes. I mean, it was just, I can't imagine having to put them back on my body. So my job was to make sure that they had a clean shower, clean towels. I made connections with people who I will never see again. And we brought a sense of dignity to each other in different ways, you know. So these women, after maybe not having had a shower for a month, let's say, or been able to brush their teeth, I mean, the relief, you can't... the relief, the sense of relief was so great. And sometimes it was just like I would watch the little kids, you know, so the mom could have her first 5 minutes to herself in I don't know how long.
The stories of what people went through before you encountered them, were mm-hmm. you hearing those firsthand?
I was hearing as much as I could, but my Spanish, I was actually calling it Spwanglish because some of the women who could understand my muy básico Spanish, and like they knew how to speak with me so that I would understand, you know. Okay. So I learned about like one woman, she was a small business owner, and just really she and her daughter, when they were there, this was just amazing. Oftentimes you would see women who were in the same situation as the other, you know, 100 to 300 people there, you know, just in their tails to take care of everybody else, you know, and helping us in the center, like serving each other. And they were just incredible. So one of these women was telling me that in El Salvador, she'd had a small business, but the gangs demand a payment every month and she couldn't afford it. She just couldn't afford it. And what happens with the people who are not paying their monthly protection fee is that they are killed.
You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, conversations that deserve more time. I'm speaking with Ellie Davis, who spent a week at the Humanitarian Respite Center of the Rio Grande Valley in McAllen, Texas. Her job was to manage the showers and the laundry within the center. What does happen to those after they leave the respite center? How many days can they stay there? What, you know, this is actually the first happy place they've been in a while.
Right. It's true. So at the respite center, they will never get kicked out.
Okay.
However, they don't have the facilities. One of the things that this respite center does, which is amazing, is help them find their contacts in the U.S. And then figure out their bus route. Like it's kind of a miracle what's happening there. So they're not set up to have people living there, but because it's a crisis now. So every night they clean out the dining area and they lay down like, you know, wrestling mats and then Red Cross blankets and the people who are staying, there they are. So typically people are there for only 4 hours. But often people are there for several days while they try to get hold of family or friends.
One thing you've said about this time is that it show to you the worst in people, mm-hmm. but also the best in people.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, you know, the worst in people, this is, you know, dropping off people who have already been tormented, dropping them off with no help or hope. And then the best in people are people like the nuns, Sister Norma and Sister Anne, who started the respite center. This Raquel Gonzalez, she was there 12 hours a day for months. This Woodson Martin, who I started to mention before, he's raised in when we were there at the same time, and he raised tens of thousands of dollars in a really short, within 4 or 5 days. All of that money goes to these families on their bus trips, because a lot of them have like these 4-day trips, and no, they can't buy their food for their families, and they have a little snack bag and maybe a couple of bottles of water to take with them. So he's putting cash in their pockets so that they have, you know, they can buy food on the trip. There's this guy, Brendan Tucker, who he gave up everything. He has a GoFundMe page, and that's how he pays his rent and everything, because what he spends his time doing is shopping and cooking for the refugees on the bridges. So he brings them food every day. He brings them their meals every day. And that's, I mean, really, there's some really good people in the world.
There was some hype when this was the big news story of the day. There was more attention. There was more outcry about the way we treat people crossing into America. Mm-hmm. That fell off for all the other hot button issues that we're seeing in the news. It's come back up again a little bit because there's this huge wave, as you said, 500 mm-hmm. this week, who, again, are trying to enter. I'm wondering what you learned can be done.
Okay, so first of all, I get that, like, anybody who's paying attention understands that, you know, there are a lot of places we can give money and time, you know, and I do actually think that if we, if every one of us were to kind of understand that, like, we can help, we can actually do something to make some sort of turn in policy. Well, okay, so maybe we won't make a turn in policy. Just vote, okay? what I would say is people knowing the truth of what's happening, knowing that this is not hype, this is how people are being treated at the border by the U.S. government. Making a welcoming place in our communities for people who are not like us. I think understanding that these are human beings. This isn't just a political game, you know. I would suggest stopping and asking what you would do if you knew that there was a real threat that your daughter was going to be sold into sex slavery. I think that's a really big thing that people can start to do is take blinders off of Republican, Democrat, or liberal, conservative, and say, human being, what's the story behind all of this?
So we're a little removed from your journey down to the border now. Mm-hmm. You went knowing you couldn't not do something, mm-hmm. that you had to do something. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine that once you got there, though, it was so clear that, for instance, you alone mm-hmm. couldn't fix this problem.
Oh, yeah.
Looking back, are you more hopeful, or mm-hmm. having taken the step, do you realize it's even worse, or it's even bigger, it's even harder? I mean, you know,
that's a great question.
Positive or a negative realization?
You know what? It's the best thing I've ever done. You know, there was no glamour in the laundry room. It was so eye-opening. Like I said, to both the cruelty and the kindness in the world. And I think that it was one big positive. Yes, it's overwhelming, you know. And yes, it is true that I am not solving this problem. by folding some towels and brushing some hair. I get it. And I know that when people know that there's somebody out there who cares about what happens to them, they have a better chance to make better choices somewhere down the line, you know? So those few people that I got to be with in that week, you know, that maybe they'll pay it forward, for lack of a better phrase, you know? It's also given me the fire to tell other people what's going on. It's given me the thought to vote again. I, you know, to be honest, I felt so betrayed by the system that I was like, yeah, voting, schmoting. But when I see this, that is one step, even if it's not a great one, it is at least a step. We can look at the choices that our representatives make. You know, are they making choices that are cruel? Are they backing cruel policy, or are they trying to actually make it a better world for all of us, not just for big corporations, whatever? For me, that's so. I'll vote, and I'll tell other people to research your candidates and vote.
Ellie Davis, thank you so much for making that trip down and for taking a little bit of time to share it with us today.
Thank you for having me, Allison. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
That was Ellie Davis, longtime Carbondale local who now lives in Sweden, sharing her experience volunteering at the U.S.-Mexico border. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Painter Emilio Perez was October's visiting artist and critic at Anderson Ranch. Perez focuses on large-scale public art projects using different media like video, paint, and mosaic. Arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay spoke with Perez about how art in surprising places can engage a community.
First of all, I want to talk about your approach in your artwork. Your artwork is so energetic and dynamic and maybe even a little psychedelic. It's really fluid. I just want you to talk about developing kind of your aesthetic.
Well, I mean, I've always approached artwork and mainly everything that I do in a very intuitive way. And I've also, you know, and primarily I'm a painter, so I've always, and a mark maker, I would say. So I've always been really interested in sort of this meeting point between drawing and painting. And for me, what I love about painting, it kind of leads to my approach, is that to me, just the brushstroke is like, it's just such an immediate sort of pure expression. And I love that kind of, that idea of being in the moment. So my work starts out really loose, and instead of kind of planning out my paintings and my work ahead of time, instead what I'm doing is that I'm just being very expressive with the paint, and then I go back into the work and use all of those brush strokes as kind of a roadmap for a drawing. And so that's when I start working back into it and putting all the lines in. And in the paintings, what I'm doing, the drawing is actually paint that's being removed from the surface of the panel that I'm working on.
Your work is on display in galleries, yes, but you're also, it sounds like, working on a mosaic installation for the Metro in New York. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm doing so. The MTA, the New York City Subway, commissioned me to do a station in Brooklyn, And wow. Right now, I mean, hopefully we're going to have everything will be done in November and installed, but I'm working on 6 40-foot-long mosaics that I'm having fabricated in Mexico City.
And then you've also created a huge mural on a boulevard in Havana. So I'm wondering, what's the draw for you to create this kind of site-specific art?
Well, I mean, in general, just doing public work in general to me is interesting because you have access and people have access to your work that otherwise wouldn't see the work if they didn't go to a gallery or to a museum. So I really love that kind of like that community interaction. And as far as the piece that I did in Havana, that was for the Havana Biennial in 2015, and which for me was a really important project just because my family comes from Cuba. And I've only been there once about 15 years ago. And although I've had the opportunity to show my work all over the world, I'd never, not that I didn't think that it was possible, but the thought just never crossed my mind of being able to do something in Havana. So when I got the opportunity to do the project and I saw where the location was, and what you don't see in the photo that you saw is that's on the Malecón, which is like the big boulevard that runs along the water in Havana. And there was something very special for me about that particular location because I grew up most of my life as a kid always sort of wondering about Cuba and dreaming about this place that I'd never visited. But while I was doing this, I was living in Miami and I basically lived my whole life and grown up on the water. So I always kind of in my mind imagined this place was just on the other side of the horizon. So when I was asked to do the project and they told me where it was going to be, I was really kind of very interested about that because I didn't think that I'd my work in Cuba ever, and two, to have such a large piece of it's now looking out in the opposite direction, looking back towards, you know, where I grew up, you know, dreaming about Cuba, was, you know, I think probably one of the most poignant parts about the piece for me.
Also, I want to talk about the Times Square piece in 2016. When people picture Times Square, they think of a lot of huge video advertisements kind of blaring in your face. But for a few minutes each night, artists' video installations also go on display. And your animation was on display in Times Square in 2016. And I'm just wondering what it was like for you to see your work on display in that setting.
Well, I mean, I still, even when I look at the pictures now, it's still hard for me to believe that I was able to do something on such a huge scale. But that, again, that was one of these public pieces that, again, was really interesting to me because your audience there, I mean, first of all, you know, there's thousands and thousands of people in Times Square all day long and just as well as midnight. But most of them have no idea, you know, that this public art piece is going to happen from 11:57 until midnight and that all those screens are going to go blank and then start showing a video. So I really loved the element of surprise there, but then also, you know, I made that piece without a lot of knowledge about making video animations. I kind of really just started from what I know best, which is painting, and sort of, you know, building from there. But my goal was really to try to make something that was going to engage with the public and hold their attention, because that's kind of like probably the biggest challenge of Times Square, because there's so much visual stimulus going on. And even though I had most of the screens were playing my video, you know, there's still a lot of distractions. So I did a lot of research, just going to see past, seeing other installations and just seeing how people would react and kind of, you know, gauged my process and my video from my research in terms of trying to like kind of constantly keep things moving. And the title of the piece is called Dream Season. And it was really, for me, this idea of sort of like transporting the viewer to, you know, kind of, you know, letting them sort of take a road trip of their own imagination. And I just felt that because there's so many people from so many different places in the world, everybody was going to be able to get something different out of the video itself.
That's cool. So you live and work in Brooklyn, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
Great, and that means the Anderson Ranch is probably quite a change of pace for you. So I'm just wondering what your experience has been there so far.
My experience has been great so far, and it is a change of pace because, I mean, a bear walked right by my studio. But you know, the thing is, I mean, for me, what's really great about coming here, one is the community. I mean, obviously, like, being out in nature is fantastic. And it's just, you know, just the change of scenery in general is great. But I think that probably the best part about it for me is that while I'm here, it gives me this opportunity to sort of really disconnect from sort of, you know, life and responsibilities in New York. And as an artist, as a working artist in New York, you know, so much of my day, you know, besides dedicated to making work, is also sort of the business aspect of what I do. And this is just like a really nice 3-week break that I don't have to, that it's not something that's on the front of my mind all the time. Here, it's really just more about the art, and the conversations are about the art and not so much about the business part.
So what are you working on, or what's in your head while you're here?
Well, while I'm here, I'm doing something that I've never done before, which is I'm doing a ceramics project. My work itself, even though I'm making paintings and they're two-dimensional objects, the paintings themselves are really quite sculptural, and they do have a lot of depth. They do have a lot of movement. So I wanted to create something now in three dimensions, but kind of using that same kind of intuitive approach that I use to my paintings. So the one major project that I'm doing is I'm creating these sculptures that can be put together. So essentially I'm creating a bunch of pieces that all sort of like lock together to create something that sort of speaks to the composition of one of my paintings.
This is your first foray into ceramics, really?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe I made a pot or two when I was like in elementary school for my mom, but it's great. You know, the thing is, I talk a lot. You know, when I speak about my work, I speak a lot about sort of that the conversation between, you know, the mark and the gesture and just kind of the feeling. And one of the, you know, and clay really, I mean, I never thought about it, I guess just because I hadn't really worked with it much, but it's really a medium that speaks to you, you know, and you can't force it to do, you know, at certain times it'll allow you to do things, but other times it won't, you know, so there is this dialogue back and forth of when and what you can do with the material itself that keeps me really engaged. I mean, the amount of time that I've been able to just stay focused working on, you know, on whatever it is that I'm working on here without being distracted is shocking to me, because normally when I paint, you know, I'm focused, but I'm also kind of distracted at the same time, kind of getting up and moving around. And here I'm just kind of just focused on the task at hand.
That was Emilio Perez speaking with arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay. Thanks for tuning into Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. This week you heard from Kristen Kay and myself, Allison Bektesh. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.